Contend for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In times of spiritual and moral chaos, it can be hard to discern truth from error and to apply it to all of life. God's word is not silent, and we don't have to be either. This is Once for All Delivered with Caleb Castro and Andrew Smith.
Hi there, OFAD lads and lasses. I am your co-host, Caleb Castro, at the Once for All Delivered podcast. I'm joined here by co-host, insert name.
Name inserted.
That's Andrew Smith, if you can't tell.
Maybe you can't tell.
Say hi, Andrew.
Maybe it's your first time.
Maybe you can't tell.
If so, welcome.
That's right.
And if it is your first time, you probably quit already because we're so disjointed.
Because we're so inane and juvenile in our discourse.
All that. Every time.
All that stuff. Well, you're jumping into more inane and juvenile discourse in talking about a variety of stuff here. We had intended to really do just a kind of one-shot episode on a variety of topics, but these variety of topics are very, very, there's a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
there's a lot of stuff happening. So anyways, we're going to pick back up here with our overview of basically a lot of stuff that we've gone over before in just about the various realms of culture.
Yep. Here goes.
Yeah, just in terms of back to politics, there's a couple interesting notes. Maybe not in recording. You and I, Andrew, have talked about something of a pushback in some ways in some of the red states against this woke agenda. And it seems to be taking little steps bit by bit in measures that would make laws for illegal actions that are done in the states. So for one example, Iowa is currently going through four bills that are in the state capitol here. For one, there's gender balance. Basically, this ends requiring equal gender representation on statewide boards and commissions. So this is basically, do you need to have X amount of females or whatever to be on your payroll? Basically, let's make it less about trying to focus on getting all the right representation and checking our DEI boxes, but to go and look at, you know, look at people's actual credentials and see if they can, you know, actually just do the job.
Yeah. What a thing.
It's just trying to focus on you know, what actually matters. In Iowa, there's a requirement for teaching patriotism, the history and the meaning of the U.S. flag, the anthem, our actual cultural heritage. There's a little bit of a double-edged sword in that, where there's, on one end, there could be the concern of basically creating an idol of the country, right? You want to be careful in those measures. And yet, on the other end, there it's also been, you know, the push in certain states to teach a revised history, the, you know, 1619 Project, for one. A revisionistic view of history of slavery in the U.S. and how that's basically colored everything we've ever done as the parochial sin of our fathers to this day. Mm-hmm. It's intended as a counterbalance, but yeah, it could be a touchy thing. I don't think it's a bad thing for necessarily teaching the history of our country and encouraging, yeah, a something of a healthy appreciation for where God has planted us and ordained for us to be raised in, to be good citizens. But first of all, we need to be citizens of heaven. That one's a little bit of a, what's the word I want to use? There's a positive and a negative to it. One other one, arming teachers, the creation of a permit to allow school staff to carry firearms if their district allows it. So even then, it's still up to the local magistrates. But this, of course, being in response to the school shootings, one which wasn't too long ago, an attempt in Des Moines.
Mm-hmm.
There's additionally legislation on defining a man and a woman. Basically, this one would require on, if this bill were to go through, this would require on government documents, on government forms, when you fill out things like driver's license or, you know, permits or whatever, then you have to write your actual sex as your gender. Mm. That shouldn't be a crazy idea, but you need to basically state if you're male or female. You don't have other options and cannot have other options on the government's record in Iowa. And so this, of course, has made transgenders and the LGBTQ Alliance very angry. That they were going outside the Capitol, shouting and trying to basically raise such a ruckus whenever the committee chair would speak. They would just start shouting and try to make it difficult for them, you know, to actually discuss the bill. So you see some of their tactics there is simply just stirring up chaos. They were shouting, you know, you will not erase us, because they're saying, oh, you're trying to erase transgenders. You're trying to get rid of us. You need to honor those that want to work according to their gender perception, their own perceived gender. They're saying basically it's unfair. Some of those at the protests were shouting things like, you know, we won't play your game. That's not why we came. There was a 13-year-old gender fluid child saying that the law attempts to write them out of existence and would endanger LGBTQ Iowans. Because you seem to need a reminder, gender is how we present ourselves to the world, and sex is based on anatomical, genetic, and chromosomal details. This is a 13-year-old. You can know my gender based on how I present and introduce myself. However, you can't know my sex without accessing my medical records, genetic testing, or you being a creep. The fact that this has to be even a thing is ridiculous in the first place. We don't even have to appeal to biology. I mean, just use your own eyes, too. Like, this shouldn't have to be a thing, and yet it needs to be, apparently.
And then when you try to make it a thing, there's a good chance they'll drag you into court and get it shot down there anyway.
Yep. That's the other part. Yeah, so even if it gets passed as legislation, then yeah, it's going to end up in the courts. And it'll get locked up in there for a year or two or whatever.
And then the flip side of this, too, is so as we see that the red states are pushing back, this sort of following off of some things we talked about when we did our episode on they tried that in a small town. You see a retrenchment in blue states of wanting to further codify and enforce all of these bad things that the red states are trying to get rid of. The LGBT issues, abortion, all the things that go with that. So like one of our subscribers just sent us an article from Minnesota where there's a trans lawmaker in Minnesota who's now pressing to codify rights for trans persons in that state's constitution.
And that person is a trans person.
Right, yeah. Minnesota is kind of a purple state, but it's been it's turned darker blue in recent years, it seems. The Twin Cities kind of run the whole state. The Twin Cities, of course, being where George Floyd was, and Ilhan Omar is from there also, very radical Democrat, a Somalia first Democrat.
Somalia first.
We don't need
that's another one we should have done at some point.
We don't need to get into that, but anyway.
Well, maybe we need to get into it sometime on immigration and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Not here today, but
someday.
That is something, immigration. And what does the Bible say about the refugee versus what's happening here?
Right. So there is some retrenchment in blue state, but then there's positive developments. There's the ones Caleb talked about. Actually, I didn't talk about this before, so winging it, but Dusty Devers is a state representative in Oklahoma. He's a bivocational Baptist minister, has become a state senator in Oklahoma. He's introduced several bills, probably don't have a great chance of passing, but at least we're getting ideas on the table. Things like, we're going to ban pornography. We're going to ban sexting for unmarried persons. We're going to ban no-fault divorce. We're going to abolish abortion. We're going to eliminate abortion in all forms. Again, not a great chance of passing, even in a deep red state like Oklahoma, but at least, you know, getting these ideas on the table, it gets people thinking about them, talking about them, and maybe something can happen.
Yeah, there are attempts is one of the... I had mentioned, you know, baby steps. This is, you know, that's the nature of it. Because again, even if the legislature is put through, they still will end up in the court system, which, yeah, our present court system is not very hopeful in being able to make, you know, truly moral decisions, God-honoring decisions. There's also a big abortion bill, a pro-life bill that's being put through that is going to be basically blocked. There's a couple things that some have been put through of, you know, banning abortion at 6 weeks, basically when a heartbeat can be detected. And that's being blocked right now by the court. And it's probably going to take about a year, maybe more, to be resolved one way or another. Basically, abortions after a fetal heartbeat are detected, there's a medical exemptions situation of the, you know, endangerment of the mother's life or other kind of complications in that manner. But that they can't be just because of, oh, you know, basically you want to.
So it's a relatively, I mean, modest and soft limitation on abortion.
So that one had been passed through and is now in the court.
Yeah, it can't be enacted and enforced, you know.
Right.
Ideally, I mean, you know, I prefer things like these bills of total abolition. Let's just get rid of all of it.
Well,
but
that's the matter here.
Even the weak compromise versions of it can't get through.
Right. Well, and that's actually the second version of it, because there was an initial one that had to be basically tweaked that now produced the present form that's tied up in the courts. But there's been another bill, the one that's actually being blocked right now, even by the Republicans and even by the committee chair, that basically would put a ban on abortion and make it punishable for the mother, that she would receive jail time, imprisonment for murder, basically. That the committee chair won't put through. He's the one that actually did the heartbeat bill. But he says, this is a terribly written bill. I'm not going to go and punish. He says, even though, you know, I've been contacted by pastors, many citizens are calling for it to be passed. He says, I'm not going to. I refuse to. So he says, it is inexplicable to me to have some on social media say that planning a course of action is somehow going against God's will. He's trying to say that because it's a bad bill, he says it would actually hinder the pro-life movement. It would hinder the heartbeat bill, and that it would ultimately undo even the little steps that have been taken so far. Anything we pass will be immediately blocked by the courts, even as we await the heartbeat decision. And this will complicate the legal landscape. So then there will be two fronts that, you know, will be similarly related. Both of them could end up being shot down, and ultimately it would accomplish nothing in the fight for life. And so he's trying to be strategic. He says, it's inexplicable to me to say that planning a course of action is going against God's will. That makes no sense to me. As a warrior in the Marine Corps, and now as a warrior for conservative values in the Iowa House, I must seek divine guidance through prayer while also preparing the battlefield for success based upon those prayers. To do otherwise will ensure failure, which is not acceptable. God gave me a brain for a reason. And so he does not want to punish a mother for aborting a child. He says mothers who abort their children need love and support, not jail time. They are victims of abortionists and the lies told to them. It has never been the goal of the pro-life community in the years I have fought for life to prosecute mothers, looking instead to provide counseling and love, considering these mothers to be as much a victim of the abortionist and the aborted child. I will not advance legislation that jails women who have an abortion, such as Bill HF2256 would allow. So he appeals to basically saying, yeah, all the various pro-life groups and pro-life attorneys I've spoken to tell me that no, don't do this. And, like, you know, they're all saying this is a terrible thing.
But what if they're wrong?
Yeah. So this is where we talked about, again, where we get into personal subjective feelings as the sticking point of actually doing what needs to be done.
Right.
Like, do we blame the background, the traumas, the emotional factors and the influence of video games and media on a murderer, on someone that commits a first degree murder, someone that commits even a involuntary manslaughter, someone in a fit of rage going and killing someone, you know, an act of passion? Do we take all those factors and say, oh, they shouldn't be given prison time, they need love? Or do we treat murderers as murderers and prosecute them?
Right.
Is abortion murder? Like, which side are you actually on here with this? Is this,
well, yeah,
like, is this murder?
If abortion is murder, are you willing to follow that conclusion where it leads? Because if you aren't, then are you going to say abortion isn't murder? And then why do we care?
Why are we doing this?
It's kind of what you're left with.
Well, there had been another bill that would make for someone who did an involuntary murder, performed an unwanted abortion to receive the penalty of increased from 25 years in prison to life. And in that bill, in this legislation, an infant, the fetus was defined as an unborn human.
Hmm.
So if we're going that direction, if we're able to go that direction, why will we not then also prosecute those who perform the abortions and the one who requested the abortion?
Yeah. At least try it along the same lines as a murder for hire, because it essentially is.
Yeah. Call it for what it is. Abortions are selfish things.
Mm-hmm.
It's wanting to put me and my life first and not, you know, follow up on my responsibilities of caring for a life that's in me as a result of, you know, me wanting to have sex.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. And it's just ridiculous.
Yeah. So as far as legal developments and pushback in red states, there's some good, there's some bad. We got a long way to go if we're ever going to get there, and maybe we won't.
Yep.
Do we want to do Heidel?
That's up to you. I've only read a little bit of it, so it's so if we do, then you'll need to do lead on this one.
Okay, we can do it, and then if it's too spicy or if it's just not good, we can cut it or make it an outtake for subscribers. So
yeah.
Okay, so last one yesterday from the day we're recording this, a review appeared on the Heidel blog. This is the site most well known for being the blog of R. Scott Clark, though he did not write this article. It is a review of The Case for Christian Nationalism by Stephen Wolfe, perhaps the most polarizing Christian book of the last few years. We've talked about it a little bit before. There's some good in Wolfe's work. He's doing a lot of looking at historic reform theology and what it's taught about the church and the state. There's some things I'm not on board with. But this review is by Shane Lems, who is a Westminster, California graduate. He's a pastor in the OPC, I believe, in Wisconsin. I don't know him personally. Don't know too much about him. But there's a couple things in this review I just want to point out and discuss briefly and quickly, relating to something we've talked about before. Way back at the beginning, we did our Christ and Culture series, and we talked about the Escondido Two Kingdoms view. You know, full disclosure, I am a graduate of Westminster, California. I disagree with a lot of things that are the theological distinctives of that school. And Lems clearly doesn't. He's more in line with it, and you see that reflected in this review. But just a couple of things I want to point out. There's one paragraph in this review. It's under the Reflections and Observations section. There's a paragraph from this article. He says, similarly, his critique of the modern in scare quotes, Two Kingdoms doctrine is inaccurate. The modern Two Kingdom view, by the way, that Wolfe critiques is very much the Escondido view. He talks about Van Drunen and Clark and some others. The modern, continuing to quote, the modern Reformed Two Kingdoms view is quite in line with the historic Reformed view of the Two Kingdoms. In fact, Wolfe's explanation of the Two Kingdoms is itself a novel one for two reasons. First, he injects postmillennialism into the historic teaching of the Two Kingdoms, resulting in kingdom confusion where the spiritual kingdom and civil kingdom essentially overlap. Second, his view of the Two Kingdoms includes a non-reformed view of the Christian's role to mature the earth like Adam was supposed to do. In a word, Wolfe's Christian nationalist view of the Two Kingdoms is far out of step with historic reformed theology. First thing I'd say is to deny that there is a distinction between historic Two Kingdoms views and modern Two Kingdoms views is just inaccurate. And this is a problem you have with this view. It will talk about theologians like Calvin and others who talk about a Two Kingdoms or a twofold kingdom. Calvin was a theocrat. Calvin believed in a magistrate enforcing the law of God and governing according to the law of God. If you read Book 4 of the Institutes, he's very clear on that. And the thing about the Escondido Two Kingdoms view is they will admit this to a point. They'll say, well, yes, Calvin was a theocrat. Basically, he needed more time to cook. If he'd had more time to work out his own Two Kingdoms idea, it would have led him to secular pluralism, I guess, because this is the view they usually end up defending. And that just simply isn't true. It isn't historic. It's not in line with Reformed confessions. It's not in line even with the confessions as they've been revised, both the Westminster and the Three Forms. We talked about all of this before.
Well, also in addition, let's just add in there, a work has been put out in 2020 from Jonathan Beakey, his PhD work on the Duplex Regnum Christi on Christ's twofold kingdoms. This is a scholarly, thorough work published by Brill, the big European dissertation publisher. This is in him showing how different the modern, quote unquote, modern two kingdoms view is from the historic concept of the two kingdoms. And let's be accurate, we'll say twofold kingdoms.
Yeah.
And he even shows that it doesn't even have a true resemblance to Lutheranism.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, it's actually a Barthian outworking, or something of a Barthian outworking in a sense, but this is not even, doesn't even bear this resemblance to Luther himself, which was far less of a strict dichotomy between the ecclesiastical realm versus the civil sphere.
Yeah. So whatever other agreements or disagreements with Wolfe I have, this characterization of the two kingdoms is just simply inaccurate. Wolfe is right about this. Maybe not in all of the nuances of it, but at the very least, he is right to distinguish historic two kingdoms theology from the modern revision that's come out of Escondido. You know, again, I say that with all due respect to my professors and such, but we have to deal with things as they are and not how we want them to be always. Another issue is that Lems here says that Wolfe injects postmillennialism into this, and Stephen Wolfe is not a postmillennialist. Stephen Wolfe is an amillennialist. He's been on the record publicly and said that at various times and places.
You get an additional element of that we have to consider that prior to the, I believe, the 1920s, amillennialism was a form of postmillennialism. Amillennialism is a new phrase, but you could read in the International Standard Biblical Encyclopedia, the ISBE, original ISBEs on the definition of postmillennialism written by Gerhardus Voss, that postmillennialism was initially in two branches, one that was chiliastic, believing in a thousand-year period, you know, a golden period that would culminate in Christ's return, versus a figurative thousand-year period that simply is just from the moment of Christ's ascension. We've always been in these last days. We're always going to be in this kind of thousand-year period simply until Christ's return, without a actual literal thousand-year duration. So even then, the postmillennialism had two branches of it. Amillennialism is just a new and more unfortunate term, meaning no millennium. That's not quite accurate.
Yeah.
We're a figurative millennium.
But Stephen Wolfe's view conforms to what is now popularly known as amillennialism. And I think this exposes a certain methodological problem that we often see by defenders of this modern two kingdoms view, is that there's a tendency to lump things together and dismiss things together that don't belong together. You know, just like I said at the beginning, I've been critiquing Meredith Quine's view of the Sabbath, and I get called a theonomist for it, which is to misunderstand theonomy, for one thing, and it's to misunderstand me, because I'm not a theonomist. You know, I've been using for my arguments things like Charles Hodge, which Charles Hodge was not a theonomist, because theonomy, as we know it now, wasn't really a thing, even in the days of Hodge. But yeah, there's just a tendency to lump anything that is not this two kingdoms view into this postmillennial, theonomic, golden age, reconstructionist vein, and then just lump it all together and then try to throw it all out together. And you can't do that. That's not careful reading. That's not careful representation. It's not good history. With all due respect to my brothers and friends even that I have in this movement, like, you guys got to do a better job. This isn't how we should be doing our discourse and our discussion and our reading and reviewing of works. And there's another point, one other point in this review I want to talk about, and that is the point where Lems accuses Stephen Wolfe, his view, of being racist. It's with some fear and trembling that I bring this up, because just the fact that I said that word means that people are going to suddenly be on offense or defense or something. But now,
well, let's just be clear in the statement of how he puts it, lest it be said that he doesn't accuse him of racism.
I'm trying to find it so I can quote it directly.
His words are simply, "I am not sure how this view can be absolved of racism." We could put it at least in terms of concern that it might be seen as racist. Wolf's monoethnic conception, that one?
Yeah, I found it.
Okay.
So there is at least one way that this view can be absolved of racism, and I will tell you what it is. In his review of the book, Lems looks at and cites pages 135 and 139, which is in the section where Wolf talks about ethnicity. Now, I'll just say, if I were going to write this book, I mean, it would be different in, you know, maybe several ways, because it doesn't exactly reflect my views. But one of the things is I would not have used the word ethnicity in this discussion at all. And if I did, it wouldn't be in the way that Wolf did. I think it's a potentially not the most careful or helpful use of language, simply because ethnicity has been loaded with so much baggage. But it is important to note that when Wolf is talking about ethnicity, he does carefully define it and distinguish it from a racialized view of ethnicity. And so I'm going to quote a couple paragraphs here on the case for Christian nationalism on page 136. It says, "When most white Americans assign themselves an ethnicity, they typically point to some distant European ancestry. I might say that I'm Italian, German, and English. Ancestry tests give us the mixed origins present in our DNA. But while these origins are not entirely irrelevant, they say little about who you are, at least with regard to your everyday life. They make your ethnicity some distant relation who is practically foreign to you and usually serves as some mildly interesting fact you use in small talk. Ethnicity as something experienced is familiarity with others based in common language, manners, customs, stories, taboos, rituals, calendars, social expectations, duties, loves, and religion. These permit the ease of action and communication, the efficient completion of common projects, clarity of mutual understanding, and the ability to achieve the highest ideals and works of civil life. Put differently, the members of a people group have the same world, sharing the same or very similar topography of experience, which makes possible the full range of human cooperation, activities and achievements, and a collective sense of homeland." So right there, it is explicitly distinguished, you know, racial and lineage distinctions, you know, based on being things like English or Italian or German or whatever, from ethnicity, as he's talking about, which is really more of a unity in culture, unity in language, unity in ability to communicate and live together and function as a society. That's not a racial thing.
In part, this also means that, yeah, he's talking about, he says people groups, but he's really talking about cultures, which even then means that you can have multiple cultures within a single area, a single place.
Right. I mean, you know, even just looking at us, we are a, I guess, multiracial podcast here, and yet culturally, theologically, Caleb and I are pretty similar on a lot of things, so.
Yeah, I'm Dutch, and he's...
I'm English.
He's a Smith.
I'm a snobby Englishman. And I think, I mean, with all due respect to Shane Lems, he should have picked up on this, because up above in the article, from pages 135 and 139, where he quotes the one line, "No nation is composed of two or more ethnicities," but then ethnicity defined according to those terms. Well, yeah. I mean, a nation has to have a certain degree of cohesion or it can't function as a nation, but that's not a racial claim or a racial issue. And I think we need to be very careful with our Ninth Commandment duties when we engage works like this. I mean, yeah, there's an uncharitable way to read this and see racism and kinism, and many have leveled those allegations, and they just don't stack up. I get it. You want to do modern two kingdom stuff. You don't like people who want to govern according to Christian anything. Okay, fine. But you need to deal with these arguments on their merits and not according to whatever this is.
Maybe in reading that paragraph for clarity, what Lems has said, His critique is that Wolf's mono-ethnic conception, so he's calling it a mono-ethnic conception. That's kind of really where this, you know, what Andrew's pointing at, the problem of how Lems is reading Wolf, because Wolf is not speaking of a mono-ethnic view here. Even as we said, he's talking about people groups really as cultures, multiple cultures. What distinguishes us as cultures? And this is not just a hereditary thing. He distinguished that very carefully. Lems continues, first, for the Christian, Christ has broken down the wall between Jew and Gentile, Ephesians 2:14. The church is comprised of people from all nations, tribes, and tongues, Ephesians 2:14, Revelation 5:9. How does it make sense, then, in a supposedly Christian world, to separate Christians into nations based on their ethnicities? And so you'd have to ask, is Wolf arguing to separate Christians into nations based on their ethnicities?
Yeah. Another thing, too, is it's weird because on the one hand, the modern Two Kingdoms view, you know, claims that they are very diligent to maintain the distinctions and separations between the church and broader culture, or the church and the world. But then here that distinction is being broken down and blurred, and it seems deliberately so. So Wolf's over here talking about culture, and then they're using a churchly critique on Wolf's discussion of the world. And that doesn't seem to be consistent either. Because what is true of the church may not necessarily be true of nations or cultures or peoples within nations. Because you could argue from this line of reasoning that Lems offers here, basically, that nations as a whole then are illegitimate. We might as well just be one giant global community, no national distinctions at all, because of the unification that we undergo in Christ. Of course, then what do you do with all the non-Christians? But that's a whole other issue.
Right. I think that's part of what Lems is talking about. Perhaps he's creating his own problem because he's viewing it from within only his own lens. He's, I think, perhaps jumping the gun or looking at even the totality of Wolf's argument of a Christian nation. So he's thinking, well, what if we're talking about a nation, who's making up that nation? What is the then ethnicity of the United States? Because he goes on to say, you know, practically speaking, if the United States becomes a Christian nation, which ethnic group gets to stay and which ones have to go? What scripture references support separating Christians based on ethnicity? And so again, that kind of begs the question of, like, is that actually Wolf's argument in the first place? Is he conceiving of a Christian nation as a particular ethnic group?
Right.
You know, what's the predominant culture here?
Yeah.
Though is more of what needs to be said. It's not which ethnicity according to hereditary, biological, genealogical factors, but the, as you had read from Wolf, experienced in terms of culture. What culture needs to be predominant? He's stating, well, it needs to be a Christian culture.
Yeah.
Not a ethnic, mono-ethnic people group, a mono-ethnic heritage in terms of, oh, like, say, English.
Yeah.
Or Indo-European or whatever.
Or white or black or whatever. Right. It's not that. It's a, what is the ethnicity? Well, the ethnicity is Christian and American. Under Wolf's framework, that would be an ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
Again, maybe not in our current moment the best terminology to use, but at the very least, like, to charge racism here, it seems like a reach, and it seems like potentially uncharitable reading of what Wolf's actually doing here.
Well, and also in the nature of charitability, we can always say, since he's not done an explicit stating this is racism, perhaps not a charge, but a
implication.
Yeah, an implication, a perceived implication of racism. So hope that would be enough to absolve Wolf from what Andrew stated. You know, it doesn't seem to be problematic for me, and I'm someone that's very much, you know, against, you know, kinism itself. I don't detect a whiff of it there.
So that is, that's it.
That's all the things.
Yeah.
And also, for the record, I am not Dutch. That's just a joke for those who particularly know me, but I'm not Dutch. I'm Mexican.
Yeah. In case you've never watched any of our videos or anything, in case you were wondering, Yeah.
Castro is not a very Dutch name.
No, definitely not. So anyway, that is our roundup and miscellany. We thank you for joining us for however many parts this will end up being. We've been recording for over 2 hours now. So
yeah, we might end up with an episode per topic and then just end up not with a miscellany, but an episode for everything.
Yep.
No, in either case, we thank you, Heidi, for sorting through this mess.
Yep. Thank you, Heidi. Thank you, listeners. Thank you, subscribers. If you have any questions, comments, complaints about any of the myriad topics we have discussed here, you can reach us of80podcast@gmail.com, Twitter and Facebook at of80podcast, or Caleb called it X earlier in the show. So what, I guess we can do that now.
I said Twitter or X, whatever it is. So I did call it both. Twix. We're just going to call it Twix.
I've really been trying to hold off on that because I think it's weird, but whatever. Yeah, that site, whatever they're calling it now. And yeah, we appreciate you listening. And we'll, Lord willing, talk to you again soon.
That's right. And if you missed any of that information, Heidi will remind you. So, take it, Heidi.
Thank you for listening to this episode. For the latest news and updates, visit our Substack at onceforalldelivered.com, where you can also support our work with a paid subscription. You can also follow us on social media at OFAD Podcast. If you like what you have heard, leave a 5-star review where you get your podcasts and spread the word about the show. Once For All Delivered is hosted by Andrew Smith and Caleb Castro, and produced by Andrew and Heidi Smith. A special thank you to our founding members, Eric and Kathy Hepker. We hope you will join us again next time on Once For All Delivered.